Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Tom Butler.
I'm Brendan Duffy.
And I'm Tom Wheatley.
And you're listening to the James Bond A to Z podcast.
Join us on this journey of discovery across the world of the 007 movies.
As we take an encyclopedic look at cinema's greatest spy films.
We'll learn about the people who made them in front of the camera and behind.
From Ken Adam to Max Zorin, with the occasional detour down a few rabbit holes. And we'll sometimes be joined by guests with unique insight into the world of Bond.
This podcast is in no way affiliated with the James Bond brand, Eon, or the Fleming Estate. We do our best to make sure the information is accurate, but sometimes we do get it wrong. If you want to correct us on something or add some more detail, email us on podcast@jamesbondatoz.co.uk.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoy the show. If you want to support the podcast, we have a coffee page at ko-fi.com/JamesBondAtoZ, and you can find the link in the show notes. Hello and welcome to the James Bond A to Z podcast, where our exploration into the people behind the 007 films has reached the letter M. My name is Tom Butler, and joining me on this magnificent mission is the masterfully mischievous Mr. Brendan Duffy.
Hello.
And matching him in mood and mystery is the mannered and magical Mr. Tom Wheatley.
Thank you.
This episode will take a look at the many creatives from behind the scenes of Bond that had a huge impact on the series, and some whose work you may never have noticed before. It's got writers, directors, production designers, cinematographers, and much, much more. One person that we won't be covering, though, is M. We'll be devoting an entire episode to Bond's boss in the near future, but let's kick things off by looking at the most prolific screenwriter in 007 history.
Yes, so M is for Maybaum, Richard Maybaum. Now, you two like to give me ones that make me go into rabbit holes, and if there is ever one that I could fall into a rabbit hole with, it's Richard Maybaum, because the amount of work he's done on the Bond films is ridiculous, and his career is also absolutely fantastic. So I'm going to try and skim over some bits, because otherwise I'll be going to be prattling on for ages. So Richard Maybaum, he was born in 1909. He's an American film producer, playwright, and a screenwriter. He is best known for his work on many Bond films, 13 Bond films, in fact, which I'll go into a bit later on. But he's also known for lots of other things as well. I found some claims. These are Wikipedia claims. I'm not sure how true they are, but based on the rest of the research I've done, they sound pretty on the nose. Apparently, his works are the first anti-lynching. Among his works is the first anti-lynching play on Broadway called The Tree, the first anti-Nazi play on Broadway called Birthright, the first film that dealt with the problem of medication abuse, which is called Bigger Than Life, the first film that dealt with the ethical and moral decisions in kidnapping cases, which is called Ransom, and the first film that introduced the American public to the importance of training airmen for the defense of the United States in war. And that's I Wanted Wings. So some pretty big claims for the man, and you notice none of those are actually to do with Bond. So you can see he's had a pretty illustrious life outside of the Bond world. But a little bit on his early life. He was born in New York City and went to New York University, and then he went to the University of Iowa to do speech and dramatic arts. When he was 22, that's when he did his play The Tree, which is the anti-lynching play on Broadway. And then he actually spent some time as an actor in the Shakespearean Repertory Theatre on Broadway. So he's got quite an interesting range of skills that he's got involved with. He worked on various things as well. I mentioned some of those things earlier. In the 1930s, he was involved with a lot with the challenging politics of depression at the time. And in 1933, when Hitler was starting to ascend to his powers of state, that's when Maybaum attacked Nazism in the film Birthright. So all of that stuff sort of led him to the world of movies, and he suddenly got a contract for MGM as a writer. And while under contract there, he wrote another play called See Me Lawyer. And it's that starred Milton Berle. I'm guessing you've heard of Milton Berle, or yeah. You don't know too much about him. And it was Maybaum's most successful play, and it ran for 224 episodes from 1939 to 1940. Over the course of his earlier career, he worked at a lot of studios. So MGM, Columbia, he went back to MGM, where he worked with Alfred Hitchcock on Foreign Correspondent, Paramount, and then 20th Century Fox. Then World War II hit. He joined the army in 1942, and he was commissioned as a captain in the Signal Corps. During that time there, he worked a lot on morale films, worked a lot on combat film footage, and worked on a documentary on the history of World War II as well. And by the end of it, he'd achieved the rank of Lieutenant Colonel. So after his time in the war, he went back to Paramount as a producer and a screenwriter, and he wrote and produced his first film, which is called OSS. And this starred Alan Ladd, somebody who's cropped up previously in episodes. And it's a fictional story of the Office of Strategic Services, which is the government agency that was came before the CIA. And this started off a very big career of working with Alan Ladd on various projects. He also wrote and produced The Great Gatsby in 1949, also with Alan Ladd. After then, he went to Warwick Films. This is when things started to kick up a notch in the world of Bond. So in the 1950s, Broccoli had signed Ladd on for a three-picture deal with Warwick Films, and he insisted on having, Ladd insisted on having Maybaum co-write the screenplays that he was involved with. So as a result, Maybaum moved over to England with his family, and he worked on some pretty big films. The Red Beret, which we've all heard of many, many times. Hell Below Zero. And he also did a film called No Time to Die in 1958, which is a war film. I found an interesting article, actually, about remembering the original No Time to Die. It has nothing to do with Bond in a story context. Yeah. But if you look at the credits, there's so many people associated with Bond, the Bond series, from that credit. So there is an interesting link to No Time to Die, the original.
Yeah, it was produced by Cubby, wasn't it?
Yes.
And when I interviewed Barbara Broccoli and asked her about the title of No Time to Die, she said that there was a poster for No Time to Die in the Eon offices, the original Eon offices. And she thinks that Cary Fukunaga picked up the title through osmosis. And that's how it ended up being the name of the film. So it's interesting.
Very interesting.
There is a link.
Useful facts. So then he also did some other stuff as well. So he started writing for television. He started doing short teleplays. Bear in mind, this was a time when television had just started. So he was pretty early in working on these projects. Then he became an executive producer at MGM TV in 1958. That's around the time where it started to get involved in the Bond series. So he was brought on to write the first Bond movie, Dr. No, in 1962. But he shared that credit with Joanna Harwood and Berkeley Mather, somebody who we'll be mentioning later on in this podcast. And he went on to work on a number of Bond films after that. Not all of them in order. So he wasn't on From Russia with Love, but he was on Goldfinger. You Only Live Twice, he didn't write on, obviously, because that went to Roald Dahl. And between that, he also did some script work on Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, which is interesting. The first Bond film that was his sole credit was on Her Majesty's Secret Service, which seems to be the one that he counts as the best Bond film, which I'd imagine, because he's got four credits on it. He did do an early draft of Diamonds Are Forever, but then they brought in Tom Mankiewicz, another person who we're going to speak about in this podcast today. And then he did Man with Golden Gun, Spy Who Loved Me, and then eventually carried on. He didn't do Moonraker, interestingly, because they preferred working with Wood. But instead, he worked on a Bond spoof called SHE, Security Hazards Expert. Oh. Never heard of this.
No.
Maybe worth looking at the trailer. And then he came back again. His tenure on this is fantastic. The amount of films he worked on over the time. When it came back to the later films, he started working with Michael G. Wilson. Their first movie was For Your Eyes Only that they did together. Then he did Octopussy, View to a Kill, Living Daylights, and License to Kill. So there you go. There's a rundown of all the Bond films that he's worked on. There's some fantastic interviews with him that you can find that really go into quite a lot of depth. And he's very, very honest in these interviews. So he doesn't hold back when he doesn't like something or isn't fond of a certain actor and things like that. So they're really interesting to see. One line that I picked up was where he talks about villains. He's very keen on villains. He says, the real trick of it is to find the villain's caper. Once you've got that, you're off to the races and the rest is fun. And he's also, Maybaum's credited quite a bit with adding humour to the James Bond films, which is something that was lacking from the books and needed to be done when they transferred it to make it more popular on the cinema screen. There are two really interesting interviews online about him, which are well worth checking out. One is from a series of interviews with the screenwriters of Hollywood's Golden Age. I've went through, there's so many different quotes and things that I could cover with the Bond films, but I'm just going to pick out a few quotes here just that really nicely sum up Maybaum and his focus on the Bond films. So when he's talking about writing Bond films, he said, basically, in a way, the pattern of the story is the same in all of the Bonds. And I think that is one of the attractions of the pictures. You have that engine working, the James Bond syndrome with all the conspicuous consumption, the luxurious locales, the beautiful women, the larger than life villains. We've carried it much further than Fleming. And he talks quite a bit about Fleming because obviously he was the earliest writer on the Bond film. So Fleming had a, you know, he would speak to Fleming quite a lot. He was changing his work straight away. And he talks quite a lot about how Fleming seemed sort of disinterested in the films and especially the screenwriting of the films. He offered him script approval. He didn't have script approval. They used to send it to him to look at. And he would make some occasional notes in it, but he never seemed to be that like engaged with it. He didn't really mind about it. He just sort of just shrugged and didn't get too involved. So he did say that one time he said to him, the pictures are so much funnier than my books. And he was a little bemused and a little obtuse about it. I thought because he really didn't understand what we were trying to make them funnier. And it's this humour that is what Maybaum gets offered in terms of what he brought to the Bond things and how they work on screen. And he also talks about how the books are going to real detail. Like Fleming will write 2.5 pages describing fish underwater. And then when it comes to the film, it's basically just, you know, a few seconds of fish underwater. That's it. It completely removes anything from the books. But he says that, you know, that's what they had to do to popularize it and to make it accessible to people. He said, partly the difference is in going from a kind of cult audience to a mass audience. It was only a cult audience of readers that kept Fleming alive for a long time before the pictures really discovered him. As books, they were not caviar to the general. He's also talks quite a bit about keeping things serious. He's really adamant that part of the sort of charm of Bond is he has to have its roots in seriousness. You have to believe what Bond is doing. And he talks quite a lot about Sean Connery and how Connery is believable as a sort of serious character, but he can do the other bits, whereas alternatively Roger Moore, he's not so positive about in a lot of ways. So he says that the audience is willing to be lenient about what is real and what is not real. They will allow you to be humorous and they will allow you to strike the humor and be serious for a moment as long as they're being entertained. Anytime you are not being serious about it, the picture suffers, which I think is quite interesting. And not something that I would have expected from... It's something you don't really think about in the later Bond films, but definitely in the earlier ones. There's always sort of grounding in there. And he also... I'm nearly done with my quotes now. He talks a bit about... He's obsessed with villains. He loves the villains. He thinks the villains are the sort of fulcrum of the films. And they have to have a level of elegance. You think about Dr. No. We actually all saw Dr. No last night. That he's a fantastically elegant villain. Like, yeah. The way he speaks. He's very charming and well put together, and he talks about how he wanted Bond to have that elegance too and not be just your sort of average action monosyllabic hero. And he actually talks about Harrison Ford in Raiders of the Lost Ark and says he has not a flicker of class or humor, even though he's supposed to be an educated anthropologist, which
it's a criticism.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, he's talking, yeah, yeah. And then the other interview, and I won't go too much depth on this, it's an interview that happened in 1983 with Starlog. I think it's a magazine that was out a very long time ago. But this interview is fantastic. He really does go to town and he's so honest with it and his work on the Bond films. He just goes in depth for quite a bit about how he really likes Sean and how Sean made the role. He says, in a strange way, some people like Roger better than Sean. I certainly don't. I think Roger does very well. He's suave, witty, and so forth. But as far as I'm concerned, he has a dimension of disbelief. He does what I consider unforgivable. He spoofs himself and he spoofs the part. When you start doing that, the audience stops laughing. Just play the part, which is quite a bold statement to make about the Bond series. So other than that, he actually died in 1991 at the age of 81. I've mentioned some of the films that he's done. So he's had quite a big back catalogue of quite impressive films that he's worked on. And you can, apparently his papers now are at his alma mater at the University of Iowa. So you can actually go and see those. Yeah. And just to finish on him, I've got a nice quote from him. He says, "Once I become involved in a Bond film, I get fascinated all over again with the difficulties and the possibilities. In between, I keep saying, well, I'd like to do another Bond, but to try and think up a new caper, something we haven't done. But something new always comes up. And of course, I'm well paid." So there we go.
Well, I mean, if you were going to compile a list of the top 10 sort of most influential people on the Bond franchise, Richard Maybaum is in there, right?
He Oh, definitely. You know, yeah. And he's also probably one of the most undervalued from a mainstream sense. I think if you picked, you know, if you went on, what's the show?
Pointless.
Maybe Pointless. I'm thinking more 1990s.
Family Fortunes.
Yeah, Family Fortunes. Who are the main things on Bond? I don't think he'd come up. I mean, you'd have people like that have just worked on the last few Bond films come up before him. But
yeah, I think if you ask my mum, she might get John Barry, but she wouldn't get Richard Maybaum. I think that's fair.
And if you think about it, he's the man who came up with the majority of the, not just tropes, but the lines. So things like Bond, James Bond, that's him. He wrote that in the first film. Things like that wouldn't happen to the other fella, that's him. So all these lines are all his. So he's just, you know, shaped this whole, you know, film series massively.
He brings a continuity, doesn't he, to that early part of the series. You know, at that stage, what did you say, he worked on 13 of the movies?
Yeah.
That's an incredible run for one screenwriter. And yes, he did work with a lot of different other screenwriters, and we'll come to another one in a minute. But having that continuity behind the scenes is just as important to the franchise as, well, it's even more important than the actor playing James Bond, isn't it? Because as we've seen, the Bond actors come and go, but the people behind the scenes often stick around for a long time. And Richard Maybaum was one of those. He saw through right up to Timothy Dalton's era, didn't he? So his influence is, cannot be understated, I don't think.
So there we go, Richard Maybaum.
So M is for Mankiewicz, Tom Mankiewicz. So from one screenwriter to another. Now, Tom Mankiewicz is an American screenwriter and filmmaker whose James Bond credits include Diamonds Are Forever, Live and Let Die, and The Man with the Golden Gun. He also did some work on The Spy Who Loved Me and Moonraker. So he was born in 1942 as Thomas Frank Mankiewicz, and he's basically a part of Hollywood royalty. You might recognise the name because his father was Joseph L. Mankiewicz, and his uncle was Herman J. Mankiewicz, who was recently the subject of the David Fincher film Mank. So his father, Joseph L. Mankiewicz, won 4 Oscars in the space of 2 years, Best Director and Best Adapted Screenplay. And in fact, he won them in consecutive years for A Letter to Three Wives and All About Eve. And so his father's Hollywood career lasted over 40 years, and he also produced more than 20 films, wrote 48 screenplays. So just his family's just huge in Hollywood. His mother as well was an actor, a lady called Rose Stradner. Unfortunately, she died from an overdose when Tom was just 16. So it's obviously quite natural that he would follow his father and uncle into the industry. He majored in drama at Yale, and then before graduation, aged 18, he worked as a production assistant on a John Wayne Western called The Comancheros. In 1964, he was then credited as production associate on a film called The Best Man, which is a Gore Vidal film. So his first credit as a screenwriter was on something called The Sweet Ride in 1968, which was a film about beach bums, but he had also written some TV before that. So where he got his big break was in 1970. He adapted the Margaret Forster novel Georgie Girl, and also a film adaptation of that into a Broadway musical called Georgie, unfortunately, that was a total flop and only closed after 3 days, but it landed him the chance to write on Diamonds Are Forever, which we discussed at length on our episode D is for Diamonds Are Forever, so you can go back and listen to that. But basically, David Picker of United Artists had seen Georgie and thought it was really good. And what they Cubby told David Picker was, we need a writer who's American, because a lot of Diamonds Are Forever takes place in Las Vegas. But we also need one who can write in a British idiom. And that's how they landed on Tom. So Georgie is based in the UK. So he can write for British voices, basically. So he signed on for Diamonds Are Forever and worked very closely with Guy Hamilton and Cubby Broccoli. And he ended up earning a co-writer credit on Diamonds Are Forever. And again, we covered that in great detail on that episode. So he did a really good job. And then he was entrusted to write the screenplay for Roger Moore's 007 debut, Live and Let Die. Again, that's something we covered in great depth recently on that episode. So after Live and Let Die, Mankiewicz returned to write The Man with the Golden Gun. And Mankiewicz envisioned this film as a jewel, and he often refers or references the Western film Shane. And interestingly, he said that he begged and pleaded and banged the table to have the Shane star, Jack Palance, play Scaramanga, but Jack Palance turned it down. Unfortunately, on The Man with the Golden Gun, there was some tension between him and Guy Hamilton. And actually, because of this tension, or for whatever reason, it ended up being his final Bond writing credit. Richard Maybaum took over the writing duties after Mankiewicz had completed his first draft. Something had happened, basically, on a scouting trip to Hong Kong with Guy Hamilton and Tom Mankiewicz, and they just found that they weren't in sync on what they both wanted from the film. So Mankiewicz asked to leave the film. He left the film after the first draft, but shared a writing credit on the finished film. Mankiewicz, he said, after the release of the film, was not happy with it. He had hoped it would be harder and more serious, and also felt that his writing on the Bond films had begun to repeat itself. Man with the Golden Gun is not a very serious James Bond film. So after that, Tom Mankiewicz was actually drafted in to do a last-minute script polish on The Spy Who Loved Me. He was unable to get a credit on that film, as all the credits had been assigned. That film is credited to Christopher Wood and Richard Maybaum. And Tom Mankiewicz said that Cubby paid me cash under the table to rewrite the picture. It had to be kept a secret, though, for the Writers Guild, so that if they didn't find out. And they had to even had to keep it a secret from Roger Moore. So when Roger asked Cubby Broccoli when Tom Mankiewicz had come on the picture, Cubby denied it, and Roger said, "Of course he's on it. He's on every fucking page. Tell him he's doing a good job." Classic Roger Moore. Mankiewicz was also hired to write a treatment for Moonraker and wrote 3 to 4 pages, which he then gave to Lewis Gilbert to go and find himself a writer. So some scenes from Mankiewicz's Moonraker script didn't make it into the film, but they were then used in later films. So the Acrostar jet sequence that came from his treatment for Moonraker, obviously that appeared then in Octopussy. And also the idea of a deadly butterfly pin in the Eiffel Tower that ended up in A View to a Kill. So again, someone with influence that lasted far longer than his own movies. So after James Bond, he got a reputation for being a script doctor, and he worked on lots of different things, including Peter Benchley's The Deep and also The Eagle Has Landed. He worked on Columbo. He worked as a consultant on that. And then he was creative consultant on Superman the Movie and Superman 2. And he went on to write scenes for Gremlins, Goonies and War Games. And he wrote an early script for Tim Burton's Batman. This was before Tim Burton was attached, but his script wasn't used. You can read it online, though, if anyone is interested. Easily found online. Right. After that, he directed 13 episodes of the Robert Wagner, Stephanie Powers show Heart to Heart, and helped develop the show. And then he worked on the film Lady Hawk with Richard Donner. He made his directorial debut with Dragnet, starring Tom Hanks and Dan Aykroyd. You seen that, guys?
I was obsessed with that film. I used to watch it every few days when I was a kid.
Yeah, it's brilliant, isn't it? Yeah. That was released in 1987. And then he also directed the film Delirious, which stars John Candy. I don't know if you've seen that one.
Great film.
Is it?
Yeah, really good.
So his career slowed down in the 1990s, and he said he was actually blacklisted when he left his agents. So that's a shame, bit of a sad end to his career. And then talking sort of later in his life, he admitted he hadn't fulfilled his true potential. He said, "It's been my fault, really. Perhaps in the beginning, I was intimidated by my family and its reputation. I think I've done good, solid work. I don't apologise for anything I've done, but I wonder if I've aimed." So there we go. Mm. But a few regrets there at the end of his career. I always think of Tom Mankiewicz and think of like the witty sort of one-liners.
Mm. American flair.
Yes. His three Bond movies are perhaps three, a bit of an ignominious run for Bond, aren't they? Diamonds Are Forever, Live and Let Die, Man with the Golden Gun, which is a shame, really, but...
Interesting trilogy.
Yes. I think you can credit him with adding a level of, what's the word, ludicrousness to the proceedings, perhaps?
Or you could say fun.
Fun, yes.
You could say well. Fun, yes.
But this way it gets, it starts to get a bit outlandish, a bit silly, doesn't it, in that sort of era. Yeah. So just to wrap things up, Tom Mankiewicz died in 2010 after having had cancer. But yeah, that's Tom Mankiewicz. It's someone we will cover again when we get to The Man with the Golden Gun, I imagine.
So M is for Meddings, Derek Meddings. Again, we have somebody who has worked on decades of the Bond films. So he was a British special effects designer. And early on, his father was a carpenter at Denham Studios. And I think we've talked about Denham Studios, haven't we?
Yeah, rings a bell.
Yeah. And his mum, she was Alex Corder's secretary. We've talked about Alex Corder as well. And so in the late 1940s, Derek was able to use the art school training to get him a job at Denham Studios, and he would letter credit titles. But then his first break actually came when he met a special effects guy called Les Bowie on a commercial, and so he joined his matte painting department. So he carved out a bit of his learnt the trade, learnt the skills, and during the 50s he was creating Transylvanian landscapes for Hammer Films. And so because the budgets were so tight, it meant he needed to be really creative and creating like string and cardboard and doing all sorts of things. And this was a skill that really sort of he was able to put to use when he was hired by Gerry Anderson. And early on in Gerry Anderson's actually TV career in terms of making his early puppet shows. So he would paint the cutout backgrounds of ranch houses and picket fences on Four Feather Falls, which is a Gerry Anderson show. Vidi, have you seen that?
No.
It's a Western.
Oh, a puppet one.
Puppet one, yeah. Mm. And then he moved on to design the models for Stingray with Reg Hill. And then moving on from that, he was given basically free rein to work on Thunderbirds. And so with all the skills he'd learned with Les Bowie, he was able to put that sort of logic to use. When you watch Thunderbirds, when they're flying through the air or they're taking off or landing, there was always a problem with how to make that look good on screen. And so he had created the background, a moving background on a runway to give it the appearance of a moving vehicle, a bit like an escalator. And so that was that just added to the realism. And obviously all the miniatures and the sets that he would explode. And I was actually watching a compilation of the explosions that he did on Thunderbirds, and it's fantastic stuff. And it goes down, and people talk about it as being absolutely iconic and being key to the success of Thunderbirds. In 1966, he was involved in the feature-length Thunderbirds, Thunderbirds Are Go, and then moved on to work on a science fiction show called Doppelganger, which is about a planet that is a mirror of planet Earth. And then he worked again with Gerry Anderson on Captain Scarlet and UFO, using the same practices he'd used before. So in the first episode of the first season of Thunderbirds, Lieutenant Bob Meddings, he was named after the Thunderbirds art director Bob Bell and the special effects supervisor Derek Meddings. And so the Thunderbirds work is something that has a knock-on effect throughout his career. But Stanley Kubrick had been impressed with the work on Thunderbirds and actually hired quite a few of Meddings' staff to supervise on the effects in 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Because of Thunderbirds?
Because of Thunderbirds.
That's crazy.
I know, yeah. Another man he impressed was Cubby Broccoli. So finally we get to Bond. So he worked on Live and Let Die. That was his first one. So Roger Moore's first Bond, which we've covered very recently. And he said, the thing that was such a success, which actually gave me a footing in the Bond films, was that at the end of Live and Let Die, there was a sequence where the poppy fields explode. Guy Hamilton called me and he said, could you do this as a miniature back at the studios? I said, yes. He said, and it will look good. And I said, yeah, of course it will. It'll look great. So we came back to England. I did the miniatures of this particular poppy field blowing up. And then the next Bond film, they brought more into it. And each Bond film that I've been involved in, they've had more and more miniatures. Cubby Broccoli was obviously impressed with the economic advantage of doing miniature, because you could save a lot of money on actually, rather than actually building these things full scale. So yeah, he was then asked to come back, like he said, for The Man with the Golden Gun. He also came back for The Spy Who Loved Me in 1977, and he worked very closely with Ken Adam and admired the work he'd done. So Ken Adam worked, as we know, he built these fantastic things at the 007 stage at Pinewood, including the supertanker. But Meddings said that he had more fun because he got to spend four months on location in the Bahamas, because he was there supervising design and construction of a miniature supertanker. So this miniature supertanker that they use is actually 60 foot in length.
Wow.
And they had to do it because it's to do with water again. Remember we talked about this in Casino Royale when they sank the house in Venice?
Yeah.
And they have to do it to a certain size, otherwise the water just doesn't look real because you can't miniaturise water. And it's the same with this. That was the smallest they could go to make the water look realistic and film it in a real ocean. And of course, probably his masterpiece, or at least the most famous thing that people know him for, is the Lotus Esprit, which converts into an underwater vehicle. So obviously this is interspersed between full size body of the car and then the quarter scale miniatures, which nobody could see where the join is. I've not looked that closely at it, but I've never noticed that it's miniature.
No.
I certainly can't tell when it flits back and forth between them.
We've seen it at the cinema, haven't we? Surprised that didn't crop up. Would have thought if it was noticeable, you'd spot it on the big screen nowadays, but I definitely didn't spot anything.
Yeah, I think we'll definitely be seeing it again when it's back in cinemas this year.
So On this crest of success, he was talked into creating the models shot for Superman. So again, that was shot at Pinewood, and the destruction of the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco in an earthquake, that was completely created by Meddings. And for extra realism, Derek Meddings, he decided to shoot on the back lot against a real sky, rather than doing it against a blue screen of sky. Again, this was a 60-foot span of bridge. And then they had Christopher Reeve suspended by wires to give that look of he's flying and it's in the distance and he's really high up. That's when you had the miniature school bus and all the cars which collide together, and then Superman dives in. Then the ice planet of Krypton, which was created from plaster and fiberglass, was built on the stage, and Disintegration was filmed with a camera mounted on an arm, which could track along. So this impressed audiences so much that he actually received an Oscar, a special award Oscar, for his work on Superman.
Wow.
I think he had to leave before they finished shooting. So there is some miniature work that isn't his, and it's one of Richard Donner's bugbears of the film.
Right.
There's a drop in quality. Once Meddings had left. So then back to Bond, Moonraker, 1979. He basically created the space station, the escape pods. They were all miniatures. just adding to, I mean, reducing the cost, but adding to that realism as well. And, you know, that's something else you probably don't consider as being a miniature. And obviously he'd learned how to do spacecraft with Thunderbirds. So, you know, he could really lean on those skills that he'd learned. He worked on Krull.
Classic.
I knew you'd like that. And he also had a visit from Tim Burton, which was that was on the Irish location of High Spirits in 1988, and it was to discuss working on Batman. So Tim Burton said it was not only his work on Bond and Superman, it actually was emerged that Tim Burton was a huge fan of Thunderbirds. and Derek Meddings actually thinks that's why he actually got the job. So again, the all-important Thunderbirds jobs really reaping rewards years down the line. So yeah, he also assisted on Supergirl in 1989, Santa Claus the Movie 1985, and The Neverending Story 2 in 1990. Then 1995 for GoldenEye, he created lots of miniature. And if you go back to the episode that we did on GoldenEye, we talk about this, the train crash, there's the plane crash, the satellite dish, especially when they're Servania, yeah, which are there then intercut, same method as like with the Lotus Esprit, intercut with real full size and then back to the miniatures. And then during post production he actually died, and the film is actually dedicated to him. So GoldenEye's got a dedication at the end of the film. His sons Mark and Elliot also worked on this film, on GoldenEye, but he died 10th of September 1995. There is, if you just Google him, the pictures of him with his miniatures, fantastic. Could scroll through them all day long. It's amazing. There's a really good one with all of the vehicles that he's created over the years, and he's just sat with them surrounding him. But again, integral, another integral character to the part of the Bond franchise.
Mm. Absolutely massive, yeah. Mm. Just all that work that goes into making these films believable. And a real spectacle on screen. The visual effects stand up to this day, right? Mm-hmm. And all of these films, they're not CGI. They are real. And sometimes you can see the joins, but God, very rarely. It doesn't take much to suspend your disbelief, does it?
No, absolutely
not.
So
better than a lot of modern CGI films.
Well, it is, because it's really happening. You know, he would blow up these miniatures and figured out a technique where you'd slow the camera down to make it look a realistic full-size explosion. It's just, it's fantastic.
Tangible, yeah. Mm.
Coffee? Medium sweet. Two, medium sweet.
Thanks for listening. We hope you're enjoying the James Bond A to Z podcast. Remember, if you want to support the show, we have a coffee page at ko-fi.com/JamesBondA-Z, where you can buy us a coffee for just £3 or for £3 a month. Thanks for listening. Back to the show.
What's the matter?
I don't feel so good. I feel so sleepy.
Damn coffee. Is that all it does?
M is for Mayhew, Phil Mayhew. Now, Phil Mayhew is a fairly well-decorated cinematographer. He was born in 1941 in England, and he is best known for his work with specific directors, John McKenzie, Martin Campbell, and Roger Gosnell. And for our purposes, he was a cinematographer on GoldenEye and Casino Royale, both, of course, which were directed by Martin Campbell. His career has seen him win various awards and get quite a lot of kudos for his art. He was nominated for the BAFTA Award for Best Cinematography for Casino Royale. He's also a member of the British Academy of Film and Television Arts, and he served as the president of the society between 2002 and 2006. And he was also honoured with the International Award from the American Society of Cinematographers in 2015. And according to notes, that's reserved for cinematographers of international repute who have made extraordinary contributions to the art form. So pretty impressive stuff from Phil there. Yeah, he was born in Kent during the World War II Blitz, and his interest in film started really early on. He says his interest began when he was about 5 years old, and he talks about his grandmother taking him to see Wembley Ice Rink to see a Christmas pantomime on ice. But apparently during that, he was only interested in the spotlight operators and the skaters, following the skaters, and the dubbing box where the singers and the orchestra added voice and music to the show. So he, at a really early age, he was just obsessed with how these things actually worked, as opposed to what was going on. He talks a lot about his love of cinema, weekly visits to the local cinema. In particular, he talks about Bambi as being a memory of his. From the age of 10, he says, I knew I wanted to be the man who sat on the camera crane as it swooped over marching soldiers or costumed extras, which is a really weird thing when you think about it. I can't imagine many kids of that age not wanting to be the star of it and actually being more interested in the camera thing. Probably something that for most people doesn't come till much later. So you can sort of see the dedication he has to this art form. He taught himself to take, process and print still photographs during his teenage years, and just took pictures of everything from landscapes around his house to just objects, just to get good at photography. Eventually he saw an advert in the London Evening News for the sales department of MGM, where he got the job as a clerk, and he was paid £3.10 a week. I'm not sure if that's good or bad. Sounds fine. sounds good. And along with his friends, he also started up making their own films, and they set up a studio that they called Studio 16, and they bought a secondhand 16mm Bolex camera to film things with. And he says, I learned so much about composition, camera angles, double exposures and editing, as well as other tricks of the trade, by making amateur films for Studio 16. We had no access to sound equipment, so we learned to tell stories with pictures, which I think is a really important point for somebody like this, who is so visual in what they do, that's probably a perfect time to learn how to make films look great when you can't actually use sound. He also worked as a librarian and projectionist, and in the evenings he would get friends over and they'd watch films and sort of go into depth about the films and understand how they were made. Until eventually his friend pointed out an advert in the Sunday Times for a trainee assistant film cameraman at the BBC. He didn't get that job, but he did get a role of studio projectionist. Then in 1964 he started a traineeship in the camera department at BBC Studios at Ealing. And eventually became an assistant and documentary cameraman. The documentary thing is interesting because it crops up occasionally in this podcast, where some of the directors and camera people did begin in documentary filmmaking. And it's definitely probably a skill set that comes from that, in the realism that you do. And he talks a little bit about that and says, the great thing about documentaries is that they teach you to be ready for anything. I learned to compose shots on the fly. I knew the editor was going to need cutaways and reverse shots. It was up to me to get them by being in the right place at the right time. Which sounds like a fantastic skill to have when you're working on a busy film set, just to sort of preempt what everyone wants and get it all before anyone even asks you for it. Mm. Probably marks the good cinematographers from the bad ones. So he spent 12 years at the BBC. And then after seeing his TV work, Tony Simmons, who was a director at the time, persuaded him to become a cameraman or operator on Black Joy, which is a film in 1977, which was low budget and used a lot of documentary filming techniques. But the film became the official British entry at the Cannes Film Festival in 1977. Mm-hmm. And the film's line producer was Martin Campbell. And that started their working together, and obviously their collaboration over 19 feature films, two of which were Bonds. So from this point, he's worked on loads of films. His career is quite interesting. It's some surprising ones in there actually, but he's become known as one of the most versatile directors in photography. And when I tell you some of the films, you'll see that versatility, because he's got stuff like The Edge of Darkness and GoldenEye, of course, Who Dares Wins, some sort of slightly less exciting ones, Mask of Zorro, Entrapment, Bicentennial Man. But more recently, he's done Smurfs, Smurfs 2, and the SpongeBob movie, A Sponge Out of Water. So very versatile when it comes to cinematography.
Yeah, I can never understand that when they move to animated cinematography. How does that work?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if you sort of, if it's a slow transition, like you, I suppose somebody who's been in the industry for so long, he will probably have sort of acquired bits and pieces over time until eventually he can just do the modern style. But I mean, you've got to adapt, haven't you? And he's clearly adapted to the way that the industry's changed, because if you didn't, he would have stopped at The Legend of Zorro.
Yeah.
But yeah, so some fantastic stuff in the list of films that he's worked on. He's also he was also cinematographer on Till Death Do Us Part, Dixon of Doc Green, Zed Cars, and the movie Bedazzled. Threw those in because I thought they were interesting. And interestingly, he's also acted in, I might try and spot him, in Casino Royale. He plays a treasury bureaucrat. He's in The Legend of Zorro, and he's also in Around the World in 80 Days in some form. As London Hobo, which is probably a role he's proud of.
Oh, cameos.
Yeah, so there we go.
Right. M is for Mendes, Sam Mendes, Sir Sam Mendes, as he is now. He was born in 1965. He's a film and stage director, producer and screenwriter, and also, for this purposes of this podcast, he directed two James Bond films, 2012's Skyfall and 2015's Spectre. He was raised in Primrose Hill, studied at Peterhouse at Cambridge, and graduated with a first-class honours in English. Whilst he was at Cambridge, he became a member of the Marlowe Society and directed several plays, and it was there that he started to get interested in cinema. After graduating, he had a few different jobs in theatres, and in 1990, Sam Mendes was appointed artistic director of the Donmar Warehouse and was there until 2002. And this is where he really made his name, a name for himself in theatre. He oversaw successful revivals of Cabaret and Oliver, put on lots of other critically acclaimed things, and stepped down from the Donmar in 2002. But while he was there, in 1999, he made his movie debut with the film American Beauty. You guys seen this?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Many times.
Oscar-winning film. He'd been approached by Steven Spielberg to direct this one. So the film won the Golden Globe, BAFTA, and Academy Award for Best Picture. Mendes also won the Golden Globe Award and the DGA Award and the Academy Award for Best Director. So he is the sixth director to ever earn an Academy Award for his feature film debut. His second film in 2002 was The Road to Perdition, starring Daniel Craig, who we discussed this on.
Not the one you wanted.
No, the Daniel Craig episode back in the day. That film was also nominated for 6 Oscars. And then following that, Sam Mendes worked on the other films he directed were Jarhead, Revolutionary Road, and Away We Go. I've seen all of those, but not Away We Go, I don't think. Have you?
No.
Revolutionary Road is terrific. It's a heartbreaking film, that one. But in 2009, Barbara Broccoli and Michael G. Wilson were producing their very first Broadway play, a play called A Steady Rain, which starred Daniel Craig and Hugh Jackman. And at Hugh Jackman's birthday party, Daniel Craig ran into Sam Mendes. And while they were at the party, Daniel Craig obviously knew Sam Mendes from Road to Perdition, but they were talking about James Bond, specifically about the troubles that they had making Quantum of Solace, and also how they really wanted to make a splash for the 50th anniversary year, 2012. And so he just asked Sam Mendes outright if he wanted to direct it, and he said straight away, yes. Daniel Craig was worried that he'd done the wrong thing by offering him the job without Eon's input, but they thought he was a really good fit to do it. And the rest of that story we'll cover when we get to our Skyfall episode. But Skyfall was obviously a huge hit, and one of the big influences on that film was The Dark Knight, Christopher Nolan's Dark Knight. And what Sam Mendes said about that was, what Christopher Nolan proved was that you can make a huge movie that's thrilling and entertaining and has a lot to say about the world we live in. And he said, that did help me give me the confidence to take this movie in directions that without The Dark Knight might not have been possible. So it was a huge hit. It was the first billion-dollar Bond movie. It won 2 Oscars, 2 BAFTAs, including the Best British Film. At that point, Mendes said that he didn't want to return to do another James Bond. And at that point, there were plans to shoot Spectre and another film back-to-back, which was just too much of a commitment for him. And so he went off and he worked on his stage version of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and a stage production of King Lear. But Eon really, really wanted Sam Mendes to come back to do another one. They'd had such a good experience making Skyfall that they really persisted. They delayed Spectre, or Bond 24 as it was at that point, to suit Sam Mendes' schedule. And he eventually agreed to do it. But as we all know, it was a much more troubled production than they'd had with Skyfall. Yes, they had more money to play with, but there were script issues. There were injuries to Daniel Craig. There were delays to the film. And again, we'll cover Sam Mendes' experience on Spectre when we get to S for Spectre later down the line. Talking about it, though, Sam Mendes said it was an absurdly compressed post schedule with 16-hour days, 7 days a week, no time off, no days off. And so after Spectre came out, Deadline asked Sam Mendes whether he would make another James Bond film or what he would do next. And he said, I'll probably be doing something else. I'm going to get out of this by saying that what is important is not doing it is not a negative. It's not me saying I don't want to do this. What it would be is me saying I really want to do this story. There are other stories to tell. I've never felt shy of shifting genres, shifting scales, moving to a movie that's completely unlike the one I'd done before. So obviously he didn't come back to do Bond 25. And true to his word, the next film that Sam Mendes made was completely different. It was a one-take film, 1917. And that went on to win a bunch more awards, including three Oscars from 10 nominations and 7 BAFTAs, including Best Picture. You guys seen that one?
Yeah, fantastic.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, terrific movie, isn't it? Very. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could say that the opening of Spectre was a dry run for that film, really, because obviously that opens with a really long, unbroken take as well, stitched together. But yeah, I loved 1917. I actually interviewed Sam Mendes for that. He was really nice. His next film will be a film called The Empire of Light, and that's a 1980 set romance film with Olivia Colman and Colin Firth. So that sounds interesting. Mm-hmm. Very different to what he's done before, but or at least the last few films he's done being action films.
Mm,
but that is Sir Sam Mendes.
M is for Mills, Alec Mills. So Alec Mills was a cinematographer, born on 10th of May 1932, and again, very similar to Phil Mayhew, got that bug early on in life and had a really keen interest at the cinema as a young boy. So he left school at 14 and decided to get a job at a small studio called Carlton Hill Studios in Maida Vale, and they specialised in making B-movies. He started off as a T-boy and then later on as a clapper loader. So he worked there for 3 years. He left Carlton Hill and went on to do national service in the Navy. Once he'd returned, he went back to film. He worked on several movies with a cinematographer called Harry Waxman. So then his first major production as a camera operator was when Michael Reed gave him a break in 1966 on The Saint. His first experience working with Roger Moore was actually with Roger Moore directing the episode that he was operating the camera on. Then in 1969, he gets to operate the camera on his first Bond, on Her Majesty's Secret Service, and he is responsible for the shots they got in Switzerland and Portugal. He said principal photography on a James Bond film usually takes around 6 months. There are several units, first, second and model, and sometimes flying and underwater, all of which have at least one camera operator. Location work can be very tiring. I think we've talked about that before with them being away months and months on end without any access to phone calls or anything. So that's understandable. He also operated the camera on The Spy Who Loved Me, Moonraker, For Your Eyes Only, and Octopussy.
Wow. Hmm.
They struggled to get him back for Octopussy because by this point he wanted to become cinematographer. He wanted to be the DOP on it. But they persuaded him to do it. And then finally, in 1987, he did get the chance to become director of photography in The Living Daylights. And he then went on to do the same for License to Kill 2 years later. He said, "I never used any diffusion in any of the bonds that I lit because it's got to be clear, it's got to be clean. I recall Cubby saying to me, 'Alec, we want it to look lovely.' I don't think they were that mad about diffusion. Someone did mention this to me, certainly somebody gave me that impression, but I had no doubts about what it was going to be. Anyway, it had to be clean, very clean, sharp, otherwise things get looking soft and it's not James Bond any longer. You're making it too pretty. James Bond's not pretty." Which I thought was interesting because more recently you could say that they've gone down it looking very pretty. He said they were 6 months they were at Churubusco Studios. So we've done the License to Kill episode and we did talk about them being away. Timothy Dalton getting homesick as well. He said the shoot in and around Mexico City was very draining because of the humid conditions. And then once they'd finished, of course, 6 months of editing, you know, which... it doesn't involve him until that final grade, which only takes a few days. So working on the project quite a long time there. He went on to make two more films with John Glenn. Christopher Columbus, The Discovery, which gets a mention quite regularly, doesn't it? We should probably sit down and watch that. And The Point Men. And then he actually directed two of his own movies in Australia called Blood Moon and Dead Sleep. He's got high praise indeed for Eon. He said, "What a wonderful company Eon Productions are. Barbara and Michael and the late Cubby were like a family to me, and they don't forget you even years after retirement." So he did retire, and in between, before he retired and after retiring, he actually taught cinematography at the National Film and Television School. And he said, "It was nice to be involved after I retired, as this was an opportunity to pass on years of experience." And he's actually written a book about his time. It's called Shooting 007 and Other Celluloid Adventures. It's released in 2014. And it's got a foreword by Sir Roger Moore. So that's one to look out for as well. I think it's quite hard to get hold of.
Yeah, one of those short-run things, I imagine.
Yeah. But, yeah. You know, another somebody else that sort of spanned across a few decades there as well.
M is for Moore. Ted Moore, another cinematographer. You should probably not class this as the M episode. Just call it Cinematographers of Bond. Never seen so many in one grouping. So Ted Moore, he is South African-British cinematographer, or was. He was born in 1914. He died in 1987. And he's known primarily for his work on seven of the Bond films, in fact, during the 60s and the 70s. He is a man that got a bit of recognition as one of the industry's finest colour and widescreen cinematographers, and so much so that he won the Academy Award for Best Cinematography for his work on A Man for All Seasons by Fred Zinnemann. He's got two BAFTA Awards for Best Cinematography for A Man for All Seasons and From Russia with Love, so must be pretty good at what he does. Another one, Back to the War. He was born in South Africa, but he moved to Great Britain at the age of 16, where from 1942 he served in the Royal Air Force. He was a qualified pilot, and he flew as a cameraman in the DH Mosquitoes with the Pinewood Military Film Unit, filming bomber operations. Sounds interesting. And during the war, he joined the film unit and began sort of developing his skills in the world of movies. When he came back, he was camera operator on films, big films like The African Queen, The Red Beret, which gets mentioned quite a lot when we do these episodes, Hell Below Zero and The Black Knight. And he was cinematographer on 1956 High Flight, which is all about the Royal Air Force, so something that he was already quite knowledgeable about and had ideas on how to film that. He worked on a few films for Irving Allen and Broccoli's Warwick Films, including Cockle Shell Heroes, Zarek, Johnny Nobody, and No Time to Die. So the original one. Twice I've mentioned that film today. Never heard of it before today. And The Trials of Oscar Wilde. In 1962, Broccoli and Terence Young chose him as a cinematographer for an adaptation of Ian Fleming's work, Dr. No. And he would then go on to make another six films, From Russia With Love, all the way through to Man With the Golden Gun, but missing a couple out. He also worked on Day of the Triffids, big, nice. Big film from 1962. The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie, The Golden Voyage of Sinbad. This is an interesting one. Orca and Clash of the Titans. So some pretty interesting films there to work on. So yeah, he's a pretty. There's not a lot I could find about him. I mean, this is the problem when you research people that died before the 90s. There's not a lot of information online about him, but he definitely seems to have been had a, played a big part in the Bond films, and certainly some of the really well remembered ones.
Definitely a huge name in the world of Bond again.
I've missed one out. He's on Call Me Buana as well.
Oi.
I've not mentioned Call Me Buana, Seth. I need to get it in.
No, we'll definitely have to cover that film in depth on an episode at some point when we've run out of things to talk about. Right, final entry. M is for Merton, Peter Merton. He's a British film art director and production designer who became the third production designer to work on Bond after Ken Adam and Sid Kane, and he worked on The Man with the Golden Gun, a film we've mentioned a lot on this episode, it feels like. He began his film career as a draftsman in the 1940s before becoming a set dresser and then moved into the art department. He worked with Ken Adam on Doctor Strangelove and then worked on Woman of Straw with Sean Connery. And then also Goldfinger, Ypres File, Thunderball and Funeral in Berlin, all Bond and Harry Saltzman related. So in 1974, with Ken Adam working on Barry Lyndon and Sid Kane working on Gold, Peter Merton got the call and was promoted to production designer for The Man with the Golden Gun. Sets on that film that sort of stand out to me when I think about it are, you know, the Funhouse, Scaramanga's Funhouse, the solar energy plant. It's all very much in the vein of Bond, right? And so talking about the sets on the film, Peter Merton said, "With the interior sets on The Man with the Golden Gun, I tried to portray our villain Scaramanga as a very educated man with great taste. Interestingly, Scaramanga's maze was the set that gave me the most trouble. It took me weeks to figure it out. We were using mirrors and playing with different colours. We had dark areas and so on. I first built it as a model and we never had a complete set. Instead, it was done as a series of little pieces of set. It was all done in editing." He continued on in the role of production designer for a total of 18 different films, including some massive movies, including The Eagle Has Landed, Dracula, and both the Superman sequels, Superman 2 and Superman 3. His last big production credit was as art director on Stargate in 1994. That was a film I was obsessed with when I was...
I remember.
Yeah, a teenager.
Absolute loser.
Peter Merton, though, he died in December 2009. So that wraps up our episode on the letter M, but there are a number of people to mention that we haven't covered in depth just because we don't have the time or the energy. Brendan, who have we got?
Well, strap yourself in. So we have Wolf Mankiewicz, and he was an English writer, playwright and screenwriter, born 1924, died in 1998. So I was going to just scratch the surface, but I found out a little story that I thought was quite interesting. So the security service actually thought it had grounds for ordering an inquiry into his political beliefs between 1944 and the late 50s, because it emerged that his wife, she'd been a Communist Party member at Cambridge. And so this all came out in 2010. So the MI5 memo asked for a report on Mankiewicz's wartime record in the Royal Army Education Corps, and it said, "This man is known to me as the husband of a Communist Party member and is himself a convinced Marxist. I think there is little doubt that he too is a party member, and I should be glad to have a general report on him." So for the next 16 years, agents actually collected information on him as he moved around Britain, and they were intercepting his telegrams, his phone calls, and they were photographing him during visits to the Soviet Union and the Soviet consulate, applying for visas to visit Moscow as part of his membership of the British Soviet Friendship Society. But then later on, MI5 decided that Mankiewicz was no longer a threat to national security, noting that he had considerable success in his film career and that he called for the withdrawal of Soviet troops from Hungary in 1956. So that was quite interesting that they spent a long time there, 16 years, stalking him to make sure he's not doing anything untoward. But what does he have to do with Bond? Right, okay, well, we did cover it, but he was the one that offered to introduce Cubby Broccoli to Harry Saltzman, because Harry Saltzman had the film rights to James Bond, and Broccoli had mentioned that he wanted to make the Bond series his next project. They then went on to form Eon, obviously, and they started on the first film. So as a reward, they asked Mankiewicz to write the first draft of the script for Dr. No. But he actually withdrew after he saw early rushes, and he thought it would ruin his reputation. And then by the time he'd asked to have his name reinstated, the prints had been made. It was too late. However, he did get to work on Casino Royale 1967, so small win, I guess. he worked closely with John Huston, their sequence, which Sir James Bond meets the representatives. I think that's at the beginning near the castle, isn't it?
Right.
The one that was shot in Ireland. He worked on that section of the script. And then he died in 1998. So M is for Martin, George Martin, who was a composer, also considered as the fifth Beatle, very heavily involved with all of the Beatles' original albums. He was born in 1926 and died in 2016. We've talked about him in Live and Let Die recently, because that's the soundtrack he composed for Bond. In 1998, I don't know if any of you listened to this, but he did In My Life, which was an album of songs by celebrities, Beatles songs by celebrities, and Sean Connery doesn't sing it, he talks In My Life. It's a good rendition, actually.
It's pretty
good. Is this the one that William Shatner's on?
Is Shatner on it as well?
It's got Goldie Hawn, Robin Williams, Celine Dion and Phil Collins are on it. But he said, I've had a bloody good innings. Knowing that I would have to finish, I decided I'll make my own last record. It's a kind of tribute to all the people I've been lucky to work with over the years. But I actually think one of my favourite pieces of his work, just going off piste here, is the Cirque du Soleil work called Love.
Yeah, it's great.
I think it's absolutely excellent. I think he worked on that with his son, didn't he?
Giles Martin, yeah.
I mean, there's loads of stuff on George Martin. We would have to do a whole new podcast to cover him properly. So, M is for Mather, Berkeley Mather, who is a writer. Berkeley Mather is actually the pseudonym of John Evan Weston Davies, who was born in 1909. His second novel, The Pass Beyond Kashmir, 1960, was actually reviewed really well by Ian Fleming, who then suggested that Mather should write the script for the first Bond film. So the script was actually already thrashed out. So Mather's task was to sort of inject a bit of satire, a slight bit of comedy into it, which then people would, moving forward, go on to really exaggerate. He was offered a percentage of the takings, box office takings, for his work on the script, but he said no and opted for a flat fee. M is for MK12, and they are a design and filmmaking collective based in Kansas.
Not in Milton Keynes.
Not in Milton Keynes, no. What a shame. founded in 2000 by Jed Carter, Tim Fisher, Matt Fraction and Ben Radatz. They've been... they do numerous works. So they do adverts and work with TV companies. But their big hitters have been Beatles and Green Day Rock Band, if you remember those.
Yes.
Games, the video games. And Microsoft's Alan Wake video game.
Yeah.
And then the in-film... graphics for Stranger Than Fiction, The Kite Runner and Quantum of Solace. So that's how they are relevant to that. And we will mention the work they did on Quantum of Solace when we get to that later episode. And finally, M is for Moses, Albert Moses. He was born in 1937, was a Sri Lankan actor. And he actually starred in two Bond films. First, he was a bartender at the club in The Spy Who Loved Me.
Right.
And then a more important role as Sadruddin, as the head of the MI6 in India, in Octopussy, 1983.
Interesting.
So he began his acting career in India in the 60s. He came over to Britain, settled here in 1970, and he was also in The Man Who Would Be King. And he actually got his role in The Spy Who Loved Me after he attended a casting where they saw actors who spoke Arabic. And then that allowed him to then go on to have the bigger role in Octopussy, where he got to do scenes with Roger Moore.
Very good. Yeah, one of those few actors that's appeared in multiple Bond films
in
different roles. Shall we have a look at the characters then, under the letter M?
Let's do it.
So, first up, Jill and Tilly Masterson. The Mastersons from Goldfinger. Thoughts on these?
Mixed bag.
Obviously, Shirley Eaton plays Jill Masterson, the one that gets killed and covered in gold. And Tanya Mallett is Tilly Masterson, who joins Bond on his mission to track down Goldfinger. But yeah, Tilly, mixed bag.
Tilly might be the one weak link in the whole of Goldfinger.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Mm.
But yeah, Shirley Eaton's fantastic in it.
Yeah, and a great ambassador for Bond.
Yeah.
Someone who's done a lot for the series. Rennie Mathis. Giancarlo Giannini.
Right. I like him in Casino Royale.
Yeah?
Yeah. I feel like he's another safety blanket for Bond.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a modern version of... well, I say modern. He's he's another one of those characters that... You know, who we got the other ones? Honor Magic Secret Service. What's his name?
Oh, you mean the father figure type thing? Yeah,
the father figure, the friend who's sort of looking out for him. I know he's not early on, but later on he is.
Yeah. Yeah, he's sort of like the French Felix Leiter almost as well, isn't he? But
yeah.
You are sort of not really sure whose side he's on to start off with. I always I think he's good in Casino Royale, but then he gets that weird death in Quantum of Solace, doesn't he? Where he gets bundled into a bin. I always feel a bit sad for him after that. Mayday.
Right then.
Grace Jones, A View to a Kill.
Where do we start?
I bloody love Mayday.
She's one of the most memorable people in the whole Bond series.
Yes.
I'm a big fan.
Yeah.
I think it's the opposite of what Tilly is to Goldfinger. Mayday is to View to a Kill. It's one of the highlights for me.
Yeah, definitely. That's
Roger.
Yeah, not for Roger. Yeah, worth revisiting our Review to a Kill episode to learn more about Mayday and how Grace Jones and Roger Moore didn't get on. But, you know, I'm a big fan of Grace Jones generally, and she's just very distinctive in that movie. It makes that movie memorable, I think.
And very threatening.
Yes.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. And then Cara Milovi, Living Daylights, played by Mariam Diabo. Also someone else who's a great ambassador for Bond.
Yeah.
Good ambassador for Bond, not such a good actor in Bond.
Yeah.
I don't know she's just sort of... I don't think she gets a good role in the film, does she? She's sort of a bit placid, not that exciting. No chemistry with Dalton.
She's fine, yeah. Camila Montez, played by Olga Kurylenko. Again, another Quantum of Solace character. And I would say she is one of the better things about Quantum of Solace.
She's certainly... I think she's an interesting one because she's probably one of the most progressive characters in a female characters in a Bond film, because she's not really a love interest, is she? She's just part of the story that he's involved with, and they never even make any attempt to make it a love story, which I think is a nice step forward. But yeah, she's definitely one of the better parts of that film.
She's no Strawberry Fields.
No one is.
She gets a lot more to do. I think she's really good. I think she's had an interesting career as well after Olga Kurylenko. I thought she was really good in The Death of Stalin. But yeah, well, let's wrap it up there then, shall we? That is the letter M done. As always, we are glad that you've listened. If you listened to this episode, thank you for joining us on this journey through the letter M. Our next episode will be on Moneypenny. So that'll be an interesting one. I'm really looking forward to doing that one. If you want to support us on the podcast, we've launched a Ko-fi page. That's ko-fi.com/JamesBondA-Z. You can donate £3 to buy us a coffee. You can do that as a one-off, or you could do it every month if you wanted to. But it all helps us put the show together, and we really appreciate it when our times are tough. So whatever you can offer is greatly appreciated. But if people want to email the show, how do they get in touch with us?
podcast@jamesbondatoz.co.uk.
And if they want to get us on social media,
@jamesbondatoz on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter.
Thanks to everyone who has supported the show so far on Ko-fi. It's really, really appreciated. We had lots of nice messages from people on there. So on that note, without further ado, it just leaves me to say that the James Bond A to Z podcast will return next week.
Thanks a lot.
Ciao.
The James Bond A to Z podcast features Tom Butler, Brendan Duffy and Tom Wheatley. The podcast was produced by Tom Wheatley, with music by Tom Inglemells, and artwork supplied by Helen Dolly.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.